Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts on KOWS 92.5. If you're just joining us, be forewarned that this is a shaggy dog story, a long and winding tale begun many, many, many months ago about an artist in San Diego in the 1990s, about an installation in a Catholic church just north of San Diego, and about a long walk that I took many decades ago. If you want to dial in on all the other stories that were told as part of this, all the many detours, you can go to The Mountain Substack. Just Google The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And you'll see some links to Spotify and also a link to Substack. If you go to the Substack, you can subscribe and you can find back episodes or links to back episodes. And also it allows me to keep you apprised of all things Mountain. For the last bunch of months, it's been almost the better part of this year so far, I've been doing a retelling of the Arabian Nights, or some of the selected stories from the Arabian Nights. And I think I'll do that until those places in the Middle East and in Central Asia where we're causing so much trouble right now, until that trouble stops. I feel that the people there and the great civilizations that were born in that region deserve at least a small measure of honor or acknowledgement. When we last left off a couple weeks ago, I was telling you about a fisherman who had gone to the sea to cast his net and seek whatever fortune he could, and he succeeded only in pulling a dead donkey out of the water. Well, he stood there again, and once again, with some measure of resilience, he took his lines, he shook the donkey from the net, he mended the net, those torn spaces, the threads and the fiber and the hemp that had been ripped by the hooves of the donkey, he mended them. Then he wrung out his net, this great tool that he used to feed himself, to feed his family, to bring fortune to himself. He spread it out across the sand there in the night. And he rose and he walked to the sea and he said, in the name of God, he said, please, please, grant me something, at least something. And he cast the net and he let it sink. And he tugged. And then the lines, he felt that they were sagged and they were tight. And he thought, oh God, thank God, he got it. At last, there's some fish. Oh my God, I caught something. His heart, it fills with joy. He sheds his clothes. He jumps into the water in the darkness, that moonlit water, the moon casting off of the surface of the water. He dives in, he grapples, he takes this net and he frees it. And then he surfaces and he pulls the net to the shore. But there, all he sees is a large water jar. It's heavy with sand and mud and dirt, and it just breaks his heart. He says, this is such a terrible day, such a terrible night. And he consoles himself with the words that we are God, and to God we return. To the universe, we are of the universe, and to the universe we return. And then he asks of the universe, he says, just please give me a break. Just this agony that is ours, this agony of life, a truce. And if you can't grant me a truce, if you can't just let me be, give me amnesty, free me. All I want is to just seek my daily bread. All I want is to feed myself. All I want is to be left alone. And instead, I just find this death, these worthless things that I haul from the sea, and nothing can help me. And then he pondered how other people less worthy than him, fools, just fools, could sit in luxury. And then wise men, wise sages would be perhaps cast into darkness and without any wick or lamp for them to light. He threw the jar away and he decided again, this time the third time. He washed his net, he wrung it out, he spread it out, he asked God for mercy, he asked the universe for mercy. He went back to the water And he cast the net. And he let it sink. And this time he pulled it up. And inside was just a bunch of rocks and bones and broken glass. Just garbage. Garbage. That was his fate. That's all that the universe was going to grant him. Nothing. Nothing but hardship, but garbage, but cast-offs. And then he thought to himself, the shape of a person's life, it's not up to you. It's not up to him. And nothing, neither your imagination nor your ink, nothing's going to keep you fed. And if success and sustenance, if they come to you, well, it's just that some places are green, some are dry as dust. For some, life is grim. For others, for the oaf, the fool, the inglorious person, they can go about, they can strut in their kingdom that isn't even theirs, not even their, nothing that they're even deserving of. Well, what's granted to us, our wages, our fate, is just a scant instance, a scant bit of what they have. And we, like birds, just wheel in the sky looking for some scrap on which to dine, while others, they get the choicest cuts, the richest cuts of flesh and meat to eat. And so the fisherman, he raised his eyes once more and he said, universe, I cast my net each night only 4 times, and I've cast it 3. So now only 1 remains. Please, in this instant, can the ocean, can the great sea serve me? Can it provide me with the fish that I so deserve, that I so need? He mended his net. He threw it to the ocean. It sank. He drew it up, but it was snagged with something heavy. Once again, he shed his clothes. He dove into the water. He struggled with the net. He freed it. He brought it to shore. And inside, he opened the net, and there was a jar of yellow brass, its mouth stoppered and sealed with lead, bearing a seal, the great seal of the King Solomon from thousands of years ago. The fisherman was glad. He said, well, at least I can sell this copper in the market. It will be at least something, at least 2 measures of wheat, perhaps enough to feed my family for a day or 2. But it was too full to move, and so he thought to empty it. He rolled it on its side, and with his belt, he pried out the plug until it came loose. He broke the lead seal. And he tipped the jar to the earth. He shook it, but nothing fell from it. It appeared to be empty. But then a thick column of smoke, the smoke of 1,000,000 fires, came from the jar. It rose, it spread across the earth and welled across the sea and into the sky, and it dimmed the sun. It turned the day into night, and the smoke gathered and it swirled, and on the earth stood the feet of a djinn, a great power, this great, great power that dwarfs everything, all of our lives, all of our fates. And its head was in the cloud, its face was like that of a wolf, it had fangs like claws, like mouth, like a cave, and shards of teeth, buckler ears, and a wide throat like an avenue, and eyes that burned like lanterns. It was a monster. It was a beast. This was the great, great djinn of death, the power of death. And the fisherman, he shuddered. His mouth went dry. But then the genie spoke to him. He said, O Solomon, prophet of God, he said, mercy, mercy. Never, ever again will I defy your words nor disobey your orders. But it was then that the sun overtook the chamber of the king Shahryar, and Shahrazad brought her story to a still. And Dunyazad, Shahrazad's sister, lay beside her and said, "Oh, this is such a wondrous story. Please don't stop. Can you tell us more?" And she said to the king, Shahryar, who his eyes were half closed in slumber, she said, "If you allow me to live another night, I will tell you far, far stranger stories. Will you grant me that? Will you forestall my death? Will you listen?" And King Shahryar said, "I shall grant you one more night."
Across the muddy Ohio, when the evening light is falling and I look towards Floyd's Knobs, where the after glories glow, and I dream home to bright eyes with a merry mouth below. She's my beauteous Katerina, she's my joy and sorrow too, though I know she is not true. Oh, but I cannot live without her, for my heart's a boat in tow, and I would give the world to know if she means to let me go as I sing the whole day through. Dresses there from Smoketown to Oldham County, be they black, red, gold, or brown, let them hang to lengths below. They mean not as much to me as a melting flake of snow. And her dance is like the gleam of the sunlight on the stream, and the screeching blue jay seem to form her name when screaming. But my heart is full of woe, for last night she made me go, and the tears begin to flow as I sing the whole day through.
I've said before that the facts belong to God, but that's not quite true. Is there really a sentience that can hold all facts? The internet holds a lot of human facts, which king was born when, which law was passed where, but the sum total of facts? the instantiation of every bacterium that has ever lived, their entire life courses, the precise firing of the uncountable neurons of all living things in every nanosecond of time, the decomposition and form of every grain of sand in every gaseous whirl of every on every planet around every sun in every galaxy in the universe. These facts belong to the universe. But there can be no sentience that can know these facts. The few facts that we know do not even register on that scale. With that, welcome to the mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. This is your host, Andrew Lewis. There are so many facts, and today I'd like to overwhelm you with at least a few. It's the least I can do. Consider it a recompense for a great work that was once left undone. Even in our world, most facts are known only to a few, and to relay even those facts and to choose the right facts can leave us muted or mumbling at best. Translations of incomplete and damaged texts, some of which are copies of one another. Generations of scholars trying to glean what information they can. We try, because something great just beyond our knowing may have occurred. And this great thing, it seems, informs both the future and the past. And if we can properly read these texts, then we will learn something important about our world and ourselves. We tell the stories and we retell them in different ways, and then new combinations of facts emerge.
Stars that shine with me and call you all. Windmaker, blow my mind and show me there's another kind.
In July 1945, a young nuclear scientist, Luis Alvarez, watched from a plane as a mushroom cloud rose over the Trinity site on the Jornado del Muerto in the southwest. Alvarez had been part of the Manhattan Project and had helped design the detonator for the nuclear bomb. A few weeks later, Alvarez would type a letter while he flew in the Enola Gay as it returned from its bombing raid of Hiroshima. Alvarez had just witnessed a device that was in part of his own devising, incinerate in an instant more than 80,000 souls. He wrote to his young son Walter, trying to explain what he had seen and done. "It was awe-inspiring," he wrote. "Already the smoke cloud was up to 35 or 40,000 feet. The ground was covered with a layer of smoke so that the city was blotted out from view. I forgot to mention the most spectacular effect of all, the light flash. It was many times brighter than the sun when we were 7 miles away. I had looked at it directly through dark glasses on the trial shot in New Mexico last month." He closed with these words: "Well, here we are over Iwo Jima and on the home stretch, so I'll stop writing and go up and talk to the pilots. I wanted to tell you about this while it was still fresh in my mind. With much love, from your father." Despite crafting a perfectly typed letter, Alvarez lacked the vocabulary to describe what he had seen. Language had failed him. 3 decades later, Alvarez would study the layer of iridium that separated the Cretaceous and Paleogene layers in the geologic record. He put forward a bold hypothesis that 66 million years ago, an asteroid 6 miles wide had hit our planet in the Gulf of Mexico, and within a few moments had extinguished nearly all life on Earth. 50 years after that, a young PhD candidate, Robert De Palma, would spend years crawling over the sedimentary layers of the Hell Creek Formation in southern Montana, just south of the Missouri River. And he would confirm that the asteroid had sent outward a 100-foot wall of water that had swept up across the American continent, destroying everything in its wake. And he would find the broken mass of fossils of creatures that would plot the signatures of their deaths, of the beads of molten glass that filled their gills and gullets as they had gazed upward at the burning sky. De Palma would come to realize that these creatures had died within an hour of that great collision. They would have felt a great air blast and a roaring sound more deafening than a 747, and then the atmosphere would have heated up to the temperature of a pizza oven. From the fossilized pollen samples could be determined the season and month of the collision. Nearly all life had perished in the month of May. The paleontologist would co-author a paper with the son of Luis Alvarez, one Walter Alvarez, the young boy who had received the perfect typescript letter posted from a plane that had killed uncountable numbers. In the incomprehensible year of 2024, my brother sent me a facsimile of that letter. He marveled over this strange artifact. The typing was letter perfect, not a single misplaced character or punctuation mark, the number of each page carefully centered. And despite its perfection, it was unable to communicate a thing. 150 years earlier, the tape unwinds backwards from Jean-Baptiste riding up the barren hill from the old Fort Stockton, back as he led the Mormon battalion over the Jornado del Muerto and the mushroom cloud looming in the future, back to his infancy as he floated upriver toward Three Forks, Montana, just a few miles north of the Hell's Creek formation, towards that moment when his father would beat his mother. Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau and Luis Alvarez would be the only humans in all of history to chart that transect from Hell's Creek through the Trinity explosion and into the consciousness of my brother.
Peaches in the summertime, apples in the fall. If I can't have the girl I love, I don't want none at all. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove. That girl was mine. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove. I could sew that pretty gal to my side, and down the road I'd go. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove. Some come here to fiddle and dance, some come here to tarry. Some come here to fiddle and dance, I come here to marry. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove. Damn if I don't leave her. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, my darling. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm going back to Harlem. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove.
John, in the studio, he lays down a thinned-out layer of oil paint on the stone hinge printing paper. He lets it dry and checks it. It takes a day. He sands down the large sheet of paper, exposing the fibers so that it will take the gouache. He waters down the gouache paint and applies a base coat to the paper. He lets this dry. 5 days pass as he prepares the paper. John squeegees ink onto the mat board plate, pressing the ink into the lines. He then wipes all the other ink off with Q-tips. Q-tip after Q-tip. He blows through hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of Q-tips. On a metal plate, you can wipe off the extra ink in a circular motion with cheesecloth. He could do this a little, but there's always a little residue. And if you can get all the ink off, it will produce a crisp line. Forms, 3 figures on the ground, the Christ on his knees. In 4 of the 6 prints that John would create, all eyes are turned toward Christ. The wise men who traveled from afar gaze down in curiosity and supplication. John the Baptist anoints him with water, recognizing him for who he is. We gaze upon his body hung on the cross. The women hold and contemplate his broken form. The apostles behold his presence and speak in confused tongues as the voice of the many inhabit their souls. But in the agony in the garden, Christ sits abandoned. His companions sleep in the foreground. He contemplates the fate into which he was born without his asking, for all time to be condemned as the object and vessel of other men. But this is the thing. Although the apostles have turned from him and he is alone, so alone, he in fact is not. We stand outside the frame in a dimension beyond his knowing, and our eyes are upon him. It is our eyes that cradle him as we attempt to reach him beyond the glass and tender him our solace. The agony in the garden required 3 drops. The inks are heavy and the print is heavily shadowed. To John, it would feel overworked. The skeleton of a barren tree rises up from the center of the image. The light of an unseen moon casts a murky shadow of the cross to the lower right. To the left, the figure of 3 of the apostles, Peter, James, and John, sleep. John and James slumber, their backs against each other and the slender trunk of the tree of death, the tree of life. Their heads are tucked in their cloaks. Peter lies curled on the ground, his body a misshapen rock. Christ's back is turned, his emaciated arms stretch forward in prayer. It is a schematic of the forlorn. The agony here, the foretelling, seems even more crushing than the crucifixion. The sadness seems not to be over his imminent death. That seems the least of it. Instead, he is possessed by the sorrow of all that shall come. It is said that Christ had brought the 3 apostles with him to Gethsemane. He had asked them to remain with him, to bear watch and to pray. Jesus spoke to his disciples, saying, "My soul is sorrowful even to death. Remain here and keep watch with me." But in the night he found them asleep. "Could you not keep watch with me for 1 hour?" he asked. From this, a millennium and a half later, was born the practice of the holy hour. In 1673, Saint Margaret Mary Alacoque had a vision of Jesus in which he instructed her to spend an hour every Thursday night at the hour of the eve of the crucifixion to meditate on the sufferings of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. The practice spread wherein an individual might sit in Eucharistic adoration and offer companionship to his holy presence for an uninterrupted hour.
Catch a boat to England, baby, maybe to Spain. Wherever I have gone, wherever I've been and gone, wherever I have gone, the blues are all the same. Send out for whiskey, baby, send out for gin. Me and room service, honey. Me and room service, babe. Me and room service, well, we're living a life of sin. When I'm not drinking, baby, you are on my mind. When I'm not sleeping, honey. When I ain't sleeping, mama, when I'm not sleeping, you know you'll find me crying. Try another city, baby, another town, wherever I have gone, wherever and gone, wherever I have gone, the blues come following down. Living is a gamble, baby, loving's much the same. Wherever I have played, whenever I throw them dice, wherever I have played, the blues have run the game. Maybe tomorrow, honey, someplace down the line, I'll wake up older, so much older, mama, I'll wake up older. And I'll just stop all my trying. Catch a boat to England, baby, maybe to Spain. Wherever I have gone, wherever I've been and gone, wherever I have gone, the blues are all the same.
Meriwether Lewis began his long journey on August 18th, 1774, when he was born in the Piedmont in central Virginia. Orphaned at the age of 5, by 18, Lewis would be the head of a plantation. By 20, he would be serving under President George Washington in suppressing the Whiskey Rebellion. He would ramble in the army for 6 years, serving in Transappalachia and in the Ohio River Valley from Cincinnati to Wheeling. In 1801, Lewis, living then in the frontier town of Pittsburgh, was called by the new President Jefferson to serve as his personal secretary. Lewis's joy in this moment was captured in a letter describing the request he had received from the president. signifying his wish that I should accept the office of his private secretary. This unbounded as well as unexpected confidence conferred on me by a man whose virtue and talents I have ever adored and always conceived second to none, I must confess, did not fail to raise me somewhat in my own estimation, insomuch that I have almost prevailed upon myself to believe that my abilities are equal to the task. Lewis would live with Jefferson in provincial Washington from 1801 until 1803. Aside from the servants, Lewis and the twice-widowed Jefferson were the only residents of the newly and poorly constructed White House. Lewis would sleep in the largely unfurnished East Room, then a damp and depressing place. Jefferson became like a father to his young secretary. Lewis would be schooled in natural science, geography, philosophy, at the regular parties that Jefferson would host at his table. In 1801 was published Alexander Mackenzie's account of his overland journey from the St. Lawrence River to the Pacific Ocean. Thomas Jefferson acquired his copy in the summer of 1802. By fall of that year, Lewis, at the age of 29, was informed that he would be appointed captain of an expedition across the continent to the Pacific Northwest. Between that summer and the following spring, Lewis learned geography, taxonomy, navigation and cartography, botany, the use of the sextant, and the manner of astronomical observations. He read the accounts of Captain Cook's journeys and histories of the western lands up to the Mississippi. By spring of 1803, Lewis knew what could be had up to the mid-reaches of the Missouri River. What lay beyond was unknown earth. It was Lewis that compiled the budget for the expedition, which he believed could be accomplished at the cost of $2,500. He would be off by an order of 15-fold. Jefferson had hoped that Lewis would be in St. Louis by August of 1803 and well up the Missouri by the fall. Lewis was dispatched to Philadelphia, where he continued studies of navigation, botany, and medicine. He purchased astronomical instruments, including a chronometer, sextants, and a surveyor's compass. He purchased 3,500 pounds of weaponry, trade goods, dried food, clothing, alcohol, tobacco, and medicines. These would be shipped overland to Pittsburgh. He learned about fossils and the anatomy of ancient beasts that were still believed to roam the prairies. Lewis would return to Washington. There he would receive his final instructions from the president, and also a letter of credit, allowing him to, quote, draw on any agency of the U.S. government anywhere in the world, anything he wanted. All consuls, agents, merchants, and citizens of any nation were called to furnish him with those supplies which necessities may call for. On July 4th, 1803, it was announced that Napoleon had sold Louisiana to the United States. And the truth was, no one actually knew the bounds of this land called Louisiana. It would grow to encompass all the land, the west and north of the Mississippi and Missouri, all the way to the Oregon country. The land that Lewis was about to explore was no longer foreign territory. The United States was now in possession of this great body of earth. The following day, Lewis departed for Pittsburgh, and the great journey commenced. He did not know that there, in that rough and tumble frontier village, he would find a keelboat not yet finished, and the dog that would be his companion for the length of his journey. Nor did he know that in 6 years, he himself, Meriwether Lewis, would be dead.
Left Louisiana on the rail line. Left Louisiana on the rail line. Lost Voice coming through the pines of Ohio. Heard her voice singing in the pines of Ohio. Saying, bless your soul, you cross that line to Ohio. Yeah, bless your soul, you cross that line to Ohio.
Good Grief is a grief support group, a place to share your thoughts and listen to others who understand the journey of grief in a non-judgmental environment. It meets at the Youth Annex of the Sebastopol Community Cultural Center at 425 Morris Street, Sebastopol, on the second and fourth Friday of every month from 2 to 4 p.m. The group is facilitated by Neil Herring, a volunteer with decades of peer counseling experience who believes in the healing power of shared experiences and mutual support. Contact him at 707-332-7882 for a brief phone or video interview before attending your first meeting. The best-kept secret in Sonoma County is not the lavender at Matanzas Creek. The best-kept secret is the Robert Ferguson Observatory, just up the hill from Kenwood. They call it RFO. It's where gifted docents teach and demonstrate astronomy to kids and adults each week with three professional hands-on telescopes plus classroom presentations. Ever heard of a star party? They have 14 of them each year. Minutes from downtown Santa Rosa, but a universe away. You can visit their event calendar at rfo.org. You can make an impact and help build a stronger local economy while earning rewards at the same time. Your Go Local Rewards card is honored at 150 Sonoma County businesses that offer discounts for cardholders. Go Local cards can be obtained free at Corex in Santa Rosa or on the website golocal.coop. Remember, every local dollar spent keeps $3 to $4 in our community. For more information, visit golocal.coop. You have been listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. As always, I thank you for taking the time to keep me company, for allowing us to have this private audience with one another. I really look forward to you coming back. It would mean the world to me. I'm indebted to Stephen Ambrose for his observations and considerations of Meriwether Lewis in his book Undaunted Courage, and also to my dearest brother for treasuring the memory and great aptitudes of Luis Alvarez. You can learn more about the Hell's Creek Formation and that fateful day in May when nearly all things died in Douglas Preston's epic New Yorker article, The Day the Dinosaurs Died. We open today with Ohio River Boat Song, sung by Will Oldham, Peacemaker by Great Lakes Swimmers, followed by this old standard, Shady Grove, sung by the dearly departed Jerry Garcia, remember Jerry Day, coming up, and Dave Grisman. And then To Ohio, sung by Low Anthem. We'll be turning out the lights with Polly Come Home, sung by Robert Plant and Allison Krauss, and Meet Me on the Mountain by Fruition and Grant Farm. Special thanks, as always, to the Blue Dot Session and their telling background loop. It would be super great if you could subscribe to The Mountain on Substack. The link appears in the episode description on KOWS website, or you can just Google The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And if you subscribe, that'll be the best way to stay notified when the next episode drops. And by all means, if you enjoyed the listen, and it makes your world a little bigger, I would be grateful and indebted if you would share with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night, wherever you are.
mountain where the wind keeps blowing our blues away. Meet me on the mountain before we must be on our way.
Two shows tonight?
Yeah. I'll be and use up your Bible statistics.
It's 2:00.
You're listening to 92.5 Cows FM, KOWSLP, Occidental, California.
Cows Radio thanks Community Market of Sebastopol for their ongoing support.